So my guest this week is Chris Anderson. I was genuinely starstruck and thrilled and a little bit intimidated to have him on the show. As I tell him at the beginning of the episode, his is a voice that I've had in my ear for the last few years because of his podcast, The TED Interview, which, by the way, is one of the great podcasts out there. If you don't know it, run and subscribe to it. In it, he interviews in some depth some of the great thinkers of our time and previous TED guests, and he gives them a full hour or more so that they can dig really deeply into the ideas that they've otherwise only had 14 minutes to present. In case you live under a rock and don't know what TED is, it's a non-profit organization that provides idea-based talks and hosts an annual conference in Vancouver. They release influential videos from expert speakers on education, business, science, tech, and creativity, with subtitles in over 100 languages. Chris is the British-American businessman who has helmed it since 2002. He is also the founder of Future Publishing, and in May 2016, he published a book titled TED Talks, The Official TED Guide to Public Speaking, which immediately became a New York Times bestseller. He spoke to me from London, and it was a great thrill to have this conversation. Chris, this is such an enormous honor and privilege for me. It really is. I will record an intro, as I always do, to save you the sort of agony of being atomized by your host. But thank you for TED, for bringing us all great ideas and bringing us together. And I want to take this opportunity to thank you personally, because you kept me sane for the last 4 years. I can't say enough about... there's something so intimate about podcasts and the intimacy of being able to take people with you wherever you are. And it's a real privilege to occupy that space, I think. And the last 4 years were shrill, shall we say. And that communicated itself, I found, even in my most beloved podcasts, there was a tone that was hard to escape. And to come to you and your guests so reliably, and to know that what I was going to get was not just a wealth of new ideas and a way of thinking, but the tone in which you handled those conversations in the midst of the shrillest, I haven't got another word for it, of times. I just say thank you. I really do. You and your guests were sanity and hope and optimism and a reason to sort of keep listening, keep moving forward, keep staying engaged. So I'm just going to steal this moment to say thank you for that.
Well, that is extremely nice of you. Extremely.
I really mean it. So so this feels thrilling, and I'm genuinely nervous having you on the show, because I feel like I know you, as I wrote in my email to you, because I've had you in my head for so long. So getting your list of books was so exciting. It's always the funnest part of this show, honestly, is diving deep into everybody's list of books. How hard was it to come up with?
Quite hard. There's obviously you know, that there's books have their own sort of performative function where it's like, oh, well, this book meant a lot to me, which, you know, so I tried to take you literally. Like I tried to do not books that were necessarily recent, lovely reads, but literally books that helped shape who I am. And so that has you thinking. And there were definitely others I could have gone for, you know, on the professional front or so forth. But these five definitely really stand for key parts of how I think of myself. And I am someone who, to some extent, lives an inner life. You know, I'm in my head, probably too much. And and so they are, a lot of them are about sort of almost reframing a worldview. But no, it was a fun process, actually.
I'm glad it was. It's supposed to be fun. I think the easier, well, maybe the harder one actually is to think of your favorites, but the ones that have left I think of it as craters when I think of it. I think of it as like being hit by meteors when you really know that a book has shaped you in some way. Let's talk about your first book. Your first book is The Last Battle by C.S. Lewis, which was published in 1956. Tell me who you were when you read this book and who you were after you read this book.
So that book was actually read to me first. It's a children's book. It was read to me when I was a child. It's been read to me several times. I think the first time I was probably 5 years old.
Wow.
And it actually gave me terrible nightmares.
That's young to read that book.
So The Last Battle is the last of seven of C.S. Lewis's sort of children's classic series that started with The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. I grew up as a Christian. It's like my parents were missionaries. It was fundamental Christianity was the whole atmosphere in which I breathed in for many, many years. And aspects of that were really good. Aspects of that were probably terrible. C.S. Lewis was the mind and the author who probably did most to make Christianity seem big to me. Many aspects of it, as I got more skeptical in my teens and early 20s, seemed absurd. You know, the punishing God who couldn't forgive the world unless he first killed his son, and like there was just absurdity to it. C.S. Lewis had a way of making Christianity seem big. He lived, he knew about mythology, and he told the Christian stories in a way that made them feel as big as the universe. And so this was the epic final battle between good and evil that had its own version of Judgment Day, of heaven and hell, and so forth. And the nightmare part was this evil god Tash with his four big towering arms that I couldn't get out of my head. But the interesting part was how he described those things. So, for example, hell, which is an embarrassing concept for Christians. I mean, to believe in a god that would believe in sort of permanent torture or whatever. But he described it in that book as in a way self-inflicted. There's an amazing scene towards the end of a group of dwarves who have they've gone through the door of, I guess it represents death, and they're in this afterlife that is actually this spectacular heavenly paradise, but they're gathered in a circle, where these beautiful fruits and stuff, and they're eating them and tasting them as sort of disgusting straw and animal droppings and so forth. And that they're proud in their refusal to be fooled. But they live in the self-created hell. So it was ideas like that made you, it gave me as a child, even from that young age, it was just inspiring and sort of incredible. But then growing up, it gave me permission to believe and to be held by this faith, and that life actually was a battle between good and evil. And that, we all had our part to play, and it certainly lent life a kind of an epic grandeur in its own way. Even though I now believe the details were wrong, but it's in terms of what shaped me, I would say for 20 years, C.S. Lewis more than anyone else shaped me.
So fascinating, because I can imagine as a child, I devoured the Narnia series and loved them, deep read and reread them many, many times. I can imagine, but I was older than you, and I didn't have missionaries for parents. I can imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, but how fusing it must have been to have had faith and allegory presented in this way, where you're being asked to, I am imagining, take the Bible as something literal, and yet you're being asked to take this as something metaphorical, allegorical. That's an enormous ask of a child to know. No, the tree of fruit is real, but the tree of knowledge rather. But your dwarves eating fruit is just fiction, darling. Like how not to have bled one into the other, or maybe your parents were careful to, or you were careful to keep these apart.
I mean, I think in some circles, some evangelical circles, C.S. Lewis was almost a little risque. You know, he took liberties with the true gospel. Mm-hmm. But to me, he just really helped make it come alive in a way which the classic Bible stories didn't always.
Right. It's been fun because previous guest this season had an earlier one, which was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So I'd already done a sort of dive into that, and it had reminded me of how enormously powerful these books are, and that his understanding of myth is like Tolkien's. He understands how powerful it is to let a grand story, that it can carry that much weight. Tolkien doesn't veers away from allegory and is much more interested in story. But C.S. Lewis embraces the size of the container and how much he can put in it. I was interested researching and reminding myself again about The Last Battle, and that there's this false god that it's all set up with. So for listeners that don't know it, the story is the whole seven is really about Aslan, this amazing lion who is a Christ figure for the and the children and the imaginary land that Aslan inhabits. And in the final book, a false god appears who is a donkey who is dressed in a lion's mane. But the donkey really is just a donkey. The brains behind him is the ape. The donkey's puzzle and the ape is shift. Okay. And they just, it all felt so Trumpian. It all felt so, I was just reminded that that's the hallmark of great allegory, is it doesn't just belong to one time and place, that you can transpose it well and comfortably.
Yes, and I'm actually not sure what false god C.S. Lewis had in mind when he was writing it. It may well have been some belief, some criticism of sort of modernist thinking, claiming that it could provide, insight, transformation, salvation for modern humans, but that all that it was actually offering was a false god. Mm. And it was using some of the language of, an enlightened life, but ultimately was false. I think he was. There are many aspects of modernism that he did not like. But anyway, whatever it was done for, as a story, it works. It's definitely a powerful story. There's a maddening characters, both of those two.
Let's talk about your next book. Your next book is How the Mind Works by Steven Pinker, which was published in 1997. I have a huge advantage with you because you've interviewed so many of your heroes that I was able to go and listen to your TED Talks together, not TED Talks, TED interviews. And I had already heard this one, so it was really lovely to revisit. As an overall, I just want to say thank you for your books because they changed my mind in many ways too. It was really fun to go in and investigate these. Talk about this one in particular, How the Mind Works. When did you come across this?
So I came across it soon after it was published. Today, Steven Pinker is best known for his books on progress. He's presented compelling data that violence is in long-term decline and that all aspects of human well-being that you can measure are actually showing spectacular progress, much longer lifespans, better health, huge progress on all manner of social issues and so forth. And it's these are findings that strike so many people who follow the news as really surprising because that's definitely not the impression we get from the news. And Pinker's been criticized as being sort of wrong or naive or misleading in different ways. His pushback is it's a strange thing about progressives that they actually don't like progress. But anyway, this work was earlier, and he's a psychologist, basically cognitive scientist and evolutionary scientist. And what, so I read this book after spending probably 10 to 15 years almost outside thought, outside what the thinking world was doing. You know, I'd read philosophy at Oxford. I'd become a journalist. I built a business, and I'd been busy, and I hadn't noticed what was going on in the world. And this book, How the Mind Works, came to me like a sort of a bolt of lightning, answering so many of the questions that I had found deeply frustrating at university. At university, my main interest probably was moral philosophy. You know, I was still a Christian. I was trying to wrestle with how to make meaning of life, and you know, what was morality? What was it to want something bigger than you were? I couldn't at that time see an answer to that question that didn't go back to God. Like, to me, in a world without God, why would anyone do anything other than lead a selfish life? What, you know, ultimately, I mean, what was there other than to do that? And so, and the moral philosophy I studied at Oxford didn't help that much. It was philosophy back then, and certainly in Oxford, was far too much about just picking apart the meaning of words and not really about trying to understand things that actually mattered in the real world. Sorry, Oxford philosophy professors, but that is my opinion.
Yes.
In many ways, I felt I learned more in a weekend reading this book by Steven Pinker, How the Mind Works, than I had in my whole time studying philosophy at Oxford. And the reason was that, I mean, it was that book has two sort of anchoring ideas. One is the mind as a piece of computation, that the mind is what the brain does, and what the brain does is computes. And that if you use a lot of the understanding of just how hard it is to write certain types of computer programs, for example, no one's made a robot yet that can do what a 3-year-old child can do. You realize just how extraordinary the mind is from that aspect. But the bigger still eye opener for me was this new lens of evolutionary biology, that you can't understand who we are and how weird we are, and things like why we feel conscience and greed and anger and all these other things, without understanding how we evolved. You know, we're animals. We've got a 3 billion year evolutionary history, and we share extraordinary number of traits with every other creature on the planet. And once you start to understand that humans come from this line of ancestors, and that what shaped the DNA that makes us now were, you know, conditions on the planet that our ancestors dealt with, certainly millions of years ago, and then in the last, you know, several hundred thousand years ago, that if you don't understand that, you can't understand who we are. And I'd say that the biggest single takeaway was that, you know, my picture of evolution was, you know, evolution is fundamentally a selfish process. It's survival of the fittest, nature's red and, you know, tooth and claw and so
tooth
forth.
And claw,
and what the insight of evolutionary biology is no, you're misunderstanding it. Genes are selfish. It's in the nature of genes that the genes that survive and proliferate are the genes that have the best chance of survival, that create the conditions that are most likely for them to survive. So in that sense, they behave as if they were selfish. But the creatures they create do not have to be selfish. In fact, the best winning strategy for a set of genes who really want to survive and thrive for the long term and be replicated is to create creatures who are not selfish.
Who collaborate.
You know, who collaborate. And so that was for me a light bulb moment, and it's astonishing to me that was never, you know, taught back at university, or and still in much of academia, evolutionary biology is still not really as big a deal as I think it should be, because to me it's foundational, and it answers so many riddles about just how, you know, how complicated we are, but the fact that you can that humans have been built to cooperate, to collaborate with each other, to actually care about each other. Suddenly all these riddles about where does conscience come from are answered in a beautiful way. And it's not to say you can still believe in God and say that, you know, this was his way of creating conscience in people and a desire to do a good thing. Or you can just, you know, go with the evolutionary story. But either way, it's extreme. To me, it was a breakthrough moment of understanding how you could think about the world. And then many, many, many other quirky human traits suddenly make sense through this lens.
Mm. It's fascinating. And it's also such an elegant thesis, right? That if you like, the hardware operates to sustain itself. And then the software is what allows it to reach out. They seem to be at odds, and yet they create this organism that has both the need to propagate itself selfishly, as you say, and the need to collaborate and create community. That both are just as essential, and then they come in different packages, yeah, of the whole.
I mean, it's a perfectly natural thing that nature is teeming with social beings, from ants and bees to dolphins and bonobos and so forth. I mean, this is a way in a complex world in which you can survive and thrive. And so, you know, that part of the mystery goes away, but it means that you can embrace it with understanding, conviction, and know that, you know, when you talk to someone who you want to persuade, you don't have to say, well, let's invent this whole new mental module to go into you, to persuade you to be good. No, it's like, this is part of you, you know, the desire to act on the interest of other human beings is a part of everyone. We just have to figure out how to bring it to the surface more often, etc. But I mean, it is part of who we are.
Mm. It's lovely. I love hearing that. It's so comforting. Let's talk about your third book, which is The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom by Jonathan Haidt, published in 2006.
I think he likes to be called Jonathan Haidt.
Haidt, thank you. But, yes, sure.
H-A-I-D-T, and I'm sure most people do call him Haidt at first time.
No, let's go with Haidt.
Haidt couldn't be further from him.
From who he is. Yeah. No, good. Thank you for correcting that. I knew his work, but not this book. So this was really delicious to climb into. The idea that your happiness, unlike your height, might be adjustable, that there might be a spectrum there, felt really interesting to me. Also, given I just listened earlier that week to you talking to Angela Duckworth about grit, and you asking her whether that was something that had a fixed point or whether that was something that one could, adjust within a spectrum.
Was grit more like weight or height? And she eventually, and this is now not the author, this is height as in tallness. She eventually said, it's about weight.
Yes.
That grit is more like weight. It's something that you can.
You had to pin her down for that one.
Do something with height. You're pretty, as an adult, you're largely stuck with.
Yeah.
But this book is a continuation in a way. Like the How the Mind Works, the Steven Pinker book, put me on a journey of really trying to understand what science taught about morality, but also meaning and happiness. Happiness is the sort of, you know, the fundamental thing that humans pursue. And there is so much that was being discovered that, to me at least, seemed somewhat counterintuitive. And I think John Haidt's book is the best wrapper for all of that thinking of how to think about happiness and the right strategy to attain it, given what we know psychologically. And he comes at it from, it's largely a psychological lens, but he's quite a broad thinker, and he takes in religious thinking, anthropology, philosophy. It's really quite a remarkable piece pulling together of all these different pieces. So he starts that book with the following metaphor for how to think about who we are. He says, you are a boy riding an elephant. Mm. The elephant is our basically the unconscious processes of our mind. Danny Kahneman would probably call system one thinking. It's the vast bulk actually of what our brains do, and it's brain systems that have an ancient evolutionary history. They govern things like fear, desire, hunger, many instincts, many sort of rapid trigger responses that we do are done by the elephant. And the truth is that in most of life, we have limited control over who we are and what happens. People are born with a particular set of traits, and what psychology shows pretty clearly is that so much of that is a given. But we do have the system two thinking, this more reflective thinking that's associated with the frontal cortex and processes that evolve there that allow us to regulate what the elephant does. Mm. We can, you know, if you picture the boy, you can sort of just gently tug on an elephant rein. And so long as the elephant isn't crazed or starving or whatever, the elephant will kind of go in the direction that the boy wants him to go. But it takes care and practice and nuance and to find the exact way. So it's this picture that, you know, part of what we have to learn to do as adults is figure out how to maneuver our lumbering selves, over which we have very little control. And I think that's, I wish that was taught in every schoolroom. Mm-hmm. I wish, you know, to me, this is the modern explanation for the language I grew up with, which is, you know, it's a battle between God and the devil, angels and demons inside us. We were born into sin. We're trying to do good, you know. And then that was, many people were brought up with a completely different worldview, which is that you come into the world as this sort of innocent, shimmering ball of potential. Mm-hmm. Anything you want to do, you can achieve. You are a special snowflake, and you can be what you want to be. Follow your passion. You know, it's a very, very alluring, very Hollywood, very hippie, very sort of enticing thing. And I think it's deadly dangerous view of the world. Mm. I don't think humans are like that at all. I think we're really weird, and I think there's so much going on inside us that if we don't pay attention to, we'll never understand how to understand each other, how to respond appropriately to each other's behavior, and how to get the most out of ourselves. Mm. So from that metaphor, you know, John Haidt talks about how to, I mean, he talks about many things in the book, but I mean, in happiness, how you could, if you nudge the elephant a certain way, you can really make a difference. So he distinguishes, you know, the first happiness hypothesis he talks about is the Buddhist idea of acceptance, of refusal to have any attachment to things, and just to find happiness within, in how you respond to suffering and so forth. And that's definitely a powerful idea. But he says it's actually that the happiness hypothesis he ends up with is that happiness lies between. Mm. Yes, within, but actually there are many things that you can consciously do to shape and influence your external world that increase your chances of fulfillment. And you know, it's things like relationships first and foremost, love, doing meaningful work, engagement with nature, experiences that take you into a flow state where, you know, you're just lost in doing something special and so forth. And I just think it's the most, I think even though he wrote it, whatever it is now, 15 years ago, I still think it's as good a piece on understanding happiness or the science of happiness as there is. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you for sharing it so elegantly. I loved learning about this. I've ordered it already so that I can read it too, because I felt the same way. I particularly loved what he, as you've already said, what he talks about with Buddhism, because I feel like meditation is something so many of us, know we're supposed to be doing, along with not eating carbs and whatever else we're supposed to be doing. And I diligently do what I can and can't help feeling that while this is a practice of enormous benefit, the accompanying philosophy of total detachment doesn't work for me, doesn't chime for me. And this, as he says, and as you say, of this business of allowing that happiness is to be found with both within and without, that yes, practicing some non-attachment, but also fostering real attachments, finding a sense of purpose, doing a job that is in service of something bigger. I found that it chimed. It just, in the way that something great does, where you feel your body knows that makes sense. Your body agrees with it long before your brain has, in a way. It was interesting doing some more diving into him, and I found this phrase that really stuck with me, and it stuck with me for all your books, actually. He talks about, in a different article, the God-shaped hole in all our lives and what we choose to fill it with. And that can be religion, it can be alcohol, it can be books, it can be whatever you choose. But he talked about it as something that all humans have, that we all come into this world with a God-shaped hole in us. And I thought that was such an interesting thing. And it linked back to your Pinker book too, that somehow we have evolved to need something sacred, something transcendent, that's actually part of our birthright, in the way that we have lungs and feet and fingers. We also have a need for something greater than us, and that in a way, the more we can honor that and fill it with something that isn't just ourselves or an altar to ourselves, that the more fulfilling our life will be. But that it takes owning that there is a God-shaped hole, in a way, that it takes some acknowledgement of that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you could argue that we're running quite a dangerous social experiment right now, where a lot of the modern world is downplaying religion to a huge degree, and I get that, and I agree that the truths claimed by religion are not as claimed, but what we're also letting go is centuries of tradition of humans gathering every week to be with each other, to worship something bigger than they are. Mm. And it's not clear to me that is letting go something that we should not be letting go. Mm. That we may, like what does it take for humans to be their best people? It's possible, we're quirky things, and it's possible that we need weekly reminding and weekly moving to a sort of a deeper spot to avoid becoming small-minded. Mm. And certainly if you look at what's happened in the world in the last few years, that there's an awful lot too much of being small-minded and not being generous of spirit. Mm. So I don't know. I have a hunch that the future may need to reinvent ways of humans collectively coming together in search of the transcendent. And I think there are many other ways you can find it. You can find it in music. I think you can find it in the awesomeness of nature. You can find it in other people. But I think John is probably right that is an important part of us, that need for, the moment that takes you out of the mundane and takes you into a place where you care about something that is much bigger than you are. Mm. That's really important not to lose.
I would venture you've done that with TED. I think TED is a secular church that we gather to talk about ideas or listen to ideas that are transcendent, that connect us. I think it's not too much of a stretch to say that in its, as I say, most secular way, that's a forum you've made.
People occasionally say that to me. Dan Dennett once said that to me, the philosopher Dan Dennett. I always push back on that because that would be an embarrassing thing. But the
I didn't call you the high priest. I didn't.
I do think that it's a beautiful thing to come together and dream and connect with other people and think about things that are outside your usual, you know, and that make the world bigger.
Mm. There's a lovely quote. There was an interview that I found with Jonathan in The Atlantic, and he wrote this or spoke this: those who find a way to be part of something larger than themselves, that are part of a noble community that is pursuing some positive and virtuous end, this brings us to the highest levels of human satisfaction, the sense that our lives are meaningful, are worth living. I think religious people, members of an active religious community, have a much easier time of that. And for atheists or secular people, it's harder. This explains one of the common findings in positive psychology, that in general, people who are part of a religious community are happier than people who are not. Which I think speaks to what you were just saying.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's talk about your fourth book, which is The Beginning of Infinity by David Deutsch, Explanations That Transform the World. Was published in 2011. This was a huge book. This is a huge book. Tell me how you found it. Where were you? Who were you after you read it?
So this was the second book of David Deutsch that I'd read, and both of them actually had a huge difference, had a huge impact on my life. David Deutsch is such a unique and extraordinary character. He's a physicist. He's acknowledged as one of the leading thinkers of, for example, quantum physics. But he's kind of a recluse. You know, he lives in a home in Oxford that's cluttered as anything, and works extraordinary hours. But has this confident mix that blends physics with philosophy, with political thinking, with aesthetics, with basically the fundamental things he believes are: one, that all of knowledge is just profoundly connected, and that you don't understand anything really unless you understand at least a bit of everything. Understanding comes from knowing how those connections go. And it was actually that belief that persuaded me to buy TED.
Really?
As it was a nonprofit, because TED was about multidisciplinary knowledge, and it seemed quirky. Like, is it just working as a short-term thing? He convinced me that multidisciplinary knowledge is ultimately what brings true and deeper understanding. So there's that. But I think it's even more surprising and profound belief is that knowledge itself is a major force in the universe. It is not just the weird flutterings inside the heads of one random ape on one random planet. Mm-hmm. It is a force as big or bigger than gravity or electromagnetism or any of the forces in the universe. And in fact, perhaps bigger, because ultimately it can control them. Mm-hmm. So this is incredible. This goes right to deal with the agony that, you know, I felt a lot of my life as a kid, like looking up at the stars and just understanding or starting to understand how crazy big the universe is and how pathetically meaningless anything happening on Earth could ever be. And it makes no sense to know that the Earth that we think is so huge is this little speck of sand in the universe. In fact, it's, you know, there's more stars in the visible universe than there are grains of sand on planet Earth, etc. It blew my mind. And it's it's awe-inspiring but incredibly depressing, because anything that we did is clearly meaningless. So Deutsch takes this view head-on and says, false, that is actually false. Mm-hmm. That the significance of something is not to be measured by its size, it's by how significant it is, how meaningful it is. He says, which is more significant, a quasar exploding, you know, it's this galaxy scale sort of explosion 100 million light years away, or the fact that 100 million miles away from that, a single human being can completely simulate every detail of that explosion in their mind. Mm. They can know what it is. Everything interesting about that explosion takes place on a smaller scale inside that physicist's mind, and they can use that knowledge to explain and predict further astonishing things. So he basically believes that the way you should think about the universe is that for 10 billion years, basically it was the era of monotony, that big things pushed around small things, big bangs pushed around little fragments or whatever. But that something then started to change and little things started to push around big things. So he defines knowledge as anything, information which can have causal impact. Mm. Information is tiny, causal impacts can be huge. So the DNA of a living thing can re-change the surface of an entire planet. Mm. There's a sort of 40 orders of magnitude scale-up effect there. And human knowledge, which he calls explanatory knowledge, it's more powerful still. He argues strongly in this book, The Beginning of Infinity, that there is no limit to what that knowledge could scale to. That in principle, for example, humans could, you could build technology that could capture the energy of a star or a galaxy and do something with it. You can basically reshape the matter of everything else that is around you. So this is utterly transformative. So basically what he's saying is that actually we may well be the most interesting objects in the universe. From that, I mean, obviously, I'm in a way I'm biased because I the work I do is about spreading knowledge and spreading ideas. So I obviously want to believe that it matters. But I find him incredibly persuasive on this topic, and it then changes. You know, that there are implications then for all of the problems and so forth that we face if you view them through the lens of knowledge. He defines, he thinks that every evil, for example, is simply a lack of knowledge. Mm. It's the lack of knowledge as to how to solve that problem. Mm. You know, if someone is suffering, the reason that is evil is because there is a lack of knowledge on how to do what you need to do to stop that suffering. Mm. And it's just a completely beguiling view. The book is... parts of it will feel impenetrable to most people. I certainly couldn't understand all of it. Some of the chapters, there's a chapter there on, for example, the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, and a chapter on infinity that are hard. But many aspects
I would think.
Of it, many parts of it, I think are accessible and amazing. I mean, he's got chapters on, because he thinks that all this stuff connects. So he's got a chapter on beauty that he tries to connect. He's got a chapter on political decision making that connects into his worldview and so forth. I think it's one of the most astonishing books of my lifetime. For me, it's the single most compelling sort of mind shifting book that I've ever read.
Mm. You make it sound that way. You really do. I loved reading around this book. And as you can imagine, it's a very hard, it's a shape shifting book to try and put your hands around without having read it, because it contains multitudes. The New York Times described it as a great, wide, learned, meandering conversation about everything: art, science, philosophy, history, politics, evil, death, the future, infinity, bugs, and thumbs, which I loved as a description. But the part that I'm struck by listening to you is, you know, we have religion that puts, or certainly Judeo-Christian religion that puts us humans at front and center, right, as what matters and why we're here. And then we have the origin of species, which displaces all of us and says, no, you belong in a continuum. And meanwhile, we've, you know, taken the Earth from being the center of the universe, and we've put the sun of the galaxy, we put the sun there. In many ways, humans have had this massive displacement, this sort of humbling, if you like, intellectually. And then this book puts us back in this, to my mind, healthier alignment and relationship with the world we live in that it says, if, as you say, information is, or knowledge is information with causal power, it arms us and it empowers us with this force, as you say, that is bigger than gravity, potentially greater than anything. We can defy gravity by sending people to the moon and beyond. It's enormously empowering and generous in interpretation without making us gods in some way. That's how I read and interpret what you're saying. Would you agree with that, or do you think is there a degree to which it's overly empowering? Does it inflate this?
I'm sure some people would say it's overly empowering. It's putting too much emphasis on knowledge, and that human knowledge is so imperfect and so forth. He's got a lot of technical arguments for saying that there is no limit to, that someone like Alan Turing has proved that there is no theoretical limit to what humans can compute. But yes, so you're right. The implication is that we are a special species on the planet, and that we have a unique set of responsibilities and skills and possibilities ahead of us. Mm. He thinks that the kind of knowledge that we have has not been present through most parts of human history, that it took very special circumstances for it to take off, for the liftoff, to start to happen. That he dates to really to the Renaissance, to the scientific revolution, and puts down to people's willingness to error correct, basically to test ideas against reality, definitely you could someone could say it leads to a sort of an arrogant view of humanity, and I would say in some ways he is saying that humans, there is no limit to what humans, or to what people, what any living thing that has reached this explanatory knowledge liftoff could do in principle. And so maybe that is an arrogant point of view, but it's also, or you could just say it's one that carries with it a lot of responsibility. We better get this right. And it certainly changes, it changes what it is to be optimistic. If you believe what David Deutsch believes, any problem is there to be solved. Like, life will always have, in fact, he said in one of his TED Talks, he said, look, that there will always be problems. Problems are inevitable, but problems are solvable. It's just simply a matter of finding the knowledge that will solve them. And if you take that as a mantra, then you have your marching orders. Let's figure this out. And so it actually takes, I think what's beautiful about that is that, so many of the problems we have, we frame right now in the shape of just, it's a power battle. It's like, I want that. No, I want that. And it becomes a one-dimensional shaming, dirty fighting game where everyone gets angry with each other. Someone with a David Deutsch view would say, well, what do we need to know to solve this problem? How can we, what is the missing knowledge here? And that's fundamentally a non-zero-sum process that creates possibility. And that's why I love his thinking.
Yeah. Speaking of possibility, let's talk about your last book. This was just a delight to get into. Your last book is The Blue Sweater by Jacqueline Novogratz. It was published in 2009. I'm going to say it for you. This is your wife's book. And it was so fun because I had so loved your TED interview with her. I just devoured. It's one of my favorites. It really was. So then to see her book on your list just made me smile. It really did. I should give the full title, which is Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World. So tell me, when you read this, had you met her? Did it come afterwards? What was the order of events?
Yeah, so this is the point where anyone listening goes, oh, give me a break. You give your wife's book on there. Come on.
No.
The thing...
No. The thing, anyone the thing who, understand. In which case, stop listening and go and find a different podcast. This is not... You're in the wrong place. Anyway.
The truth is that we were already married when she published this book. But... I fell in love with her because of how she saw the world. She was actually one of the first people to speak when I took over TED. She spoke there in the first year. So Jacqueline has spent her life basically battling poverty, and has done so in an amazing way. You know, she started off as a banker, but abandoned it because she didn't think that banking was really helping the poor. She went to Africa. She started a microfinance bank in Rwanda, and lived for years in this world of trying to see, you know, what the banking systems could do, and looking at the same time at what all these government aid projects were trying to do, and what philanthropic projects were trying to do, and none of it was really working. You know, capitalism tended often to exploit the poor. Aid projects tended to create dependency. She ended up finding a way of fusing the two, getting the best of both, and finding a way that tackles poverty without taking away dignity, actually building dignity. And the path that she found to do it was through entrepreneurship. So it's yes, you know, there's huge power in the markets. If you build a business that is successful, it becomes self-funding, and so it can scale. And that is the fundamental insight, which is why capitalism, when it has worked amazingly. It's why hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty in China and so forth. Capitalism can have a huge role to play. But the entrepreneurs who are most likely to focus on the actual needs of the poor face special problems in starting up a business. You know, their customers, A, have no money, B, live in villages that are impossible to reach. You can't distribute to them. You can't market to them. It's a nightmare. No sane investor would ever invest in a business for whom that was the end goal. So Jacqueline built an organization, which did. It's called Acumen. She uses, you know, what she calls patient capital.
I love that expression so much. I went to her website to research this, and the patient capital is just such a beautiful expression and concept. It's wonderful.
I mean, most sane investors put money into a business, hoping that within 5 to 7 years, they can get money back out and do something. For this type of business, that's almost certainly not going to work. You need to allow much longer, and you need to spend a lot of money accompanying these entrepreneurs and giving them extra resources. And you know, it's a lonely, lonely, hard business trying to you know, do something like, say, to bring clean, drinkable water to remote villages. That's a really hard thing to do and to make the numbers work. And so it takes time. Anyway, The Blue Sweater is basically her memoir, her story of how, you know, she went out to Africa to change the world, fell flat on her face, failed, you know, what she learned, and the whole story of how she got to this idea of patient capital. And it's incredible. I mean, obviously I'm biased on this, but I mean, it's written in an extraordinarily honest, endearing way that is funny and insightful and all around incredible. I think for anyone who's interested in how do you actually change the world in a smart way, there's so much to offer from that book, and also from her follow-up book, more recently published, Manifesto for a Moral Revolution.
I was looking at that too. They're beautiful. It's so, you know, something that emerges from your books and then sort of culminates in your wife's book is this sense of needing to belong to something bigger, right? Of having a real sense of yoking yourself. And I've heard it over and over, not just in her conversation with you, but listening to her elsewhere, of getting up in the morning and saying, what can I do to help? And it's such a simple question. And it's a question I think so few of us think to ask ourselves, besieged as we are by, you know, small children, the mortgage, politics, whatever it is. And yet it could be such a robust question in its way. And it doesn't have to be vast in scope. It can be as little as, can I smile at the man who made me my coffee? Can I tip him in a way that feels appropriate for me and him? Can I, you know, how do you contribute? And I'm really struck by that with your books and with what the ethos of TED is too.
Yeah, the danger, of course, is it all sounds terribly lofty and so forth. But I think the truth is that it's one of the proven secrets to happiness it's a weird paradox in how we are, that we are often deceived by ourselves into thinking, you know, that the path to happiness is, I don't know, acquisition, consumption, whatever. Actually, you get it when you can get lost in something that's bigger than you are. It is just a joyful thing. So I don't think you need to sort of beg someone earnestly to, you know, do the moral thing. You almost just need to say, try this, you know, like this is an important part of yourself. You know, if you don't try this part of yourself, you're missing out on something.
I agree. I think it's true. As you talk about it, I forget whether it's you or she that coins the phrase, having the moral imagination to conceive of it. And she, there you are. Thank you. Generous. And I love that phrase, and I perhaps inevitably draw it back to reading, which is itself an act of moral imagination, right? That you're given your prompt and you're given your world. The imperative when you're alone, don't have a textbook or a book to do it with, is what's the world you can conceive of. But I would argue if you can read, you can make that leap. They're not actually that dissimilar.
Yeah, I think in the West, I mean, many, you know, imagination is a big deal for many people, but it's often done in the spirit of, there's a sort of narcissism often to it. And moral imagination is when you start, you combine the sort of the joy of imagination, but your start point is immersion in someone else's world and someone else's needs and someone else's issues. And, you know, you're trying to think, well, what could you do that would make things better there or contribute in some way? And so it's but it's a different way of framing morality. It's a much more pleasurable and I think ultimately impactful way of framing morality, which is normally just immerse and then the outcomes are, you know, write a check or don't, or you know, whatever. To actually be willing to engage in an act of imagination about what could solve this, that can be the start of something really big.
This is so lovely. Chris, thank you so, so much. This was an absolute delight. I could have talked about all these books and so much more. Thank you for sharing them truly, just selfishly with me. I did not know these books. I knew some of them. I knew some of the authors, but you opened my mind to new titles in the sort of biggest sense of that word. You really did. So I'm so, so grateful to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight, Sonia. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. My deep thanks to Chris for sharing his knowledge and time and his books and his worldview with us. I found myself thinking about these books for months afterwards, and I'm still diligently working my way through some of them now. It's such a fun example of how fun it is to find yourself reading beyond your usual parameters and swimming in waters you might not otherwise venture into. I wonder, do you like books that challenge you, or do you go to books for comfort and the familiar? Do you like to be reassured, or do you like to be questioned? Will you share some of the ones that took you to the edge of what you know on our Instagram page, Bookish with Sonia? I'm so grateful to Chris for making his time, and to Karen Navarre and Erin Allweiss for helping make this happen. Thank you to Bree Weiss, as ever, for producing the episode. And you can find the books, as always, in our show notes, or go to our website. Please like, subscribe, review. It really, really helps us if you leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. Buy a book. Give one to a friend. Surprise yourself. And join me next week for my interview with the winner of the 2020 Man Booker Prize, Douglas Stewart.